materials and turn things over to your official session facilitator, Frank Avasado. And with that, Frank, please feel free to begin.
Thank you, Jean, and welcome, everyone. Thank you all for tuning in to our Superfund Redevelopment webinar. My name is Frank Avasado, and I work with Superfund Redevelopment here at EPA headquarters as the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Project Manager. I am so glad you have joined us today. Superfund Redevelopment webinars share site reuse success stories as well as challenges with the hope that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Each webinar provides guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. Next slide, please. Today, we'll be discussing a few best practices for successful Superfund site redevelopment and the available tools and liability protections for purchasers and tenants using the real-world example of the Solatron microwave site located in Florida in Region 4. Next slide. Here's a preview of what we'll be covering today. After some brief background on SRI and the benefits of redeveloping contaminated properties, we'll have the chance to hear from key players who were involved during the early cleanup and redevelopment days of the Solatron microwave site. We'll hear from Janet Kozan, site owner and president of Paradise Properties, and the remedial project manager at the time, Bill Denman, who is now the redevelopment and chemicals branch chief in RCRA, and the former EPA attorney on the site, Kat West, who is now an EPA contractor. They will discuss their experiences and some best practices learned from this very successful reuse effort. And then we'll hear from Phil Page from EPA's Office of Site Remediation Enforcement, who will share additional information about the extremely helpful and innovative prospective purchaser inquiry tool that Bill and Kat developed for the Solatron microwave site, which is now used in many of the EPA regions. Next slide. From there, Bill and Phil will share additional information about the steps of the PPI tool, including discussing compatibility of the proposed reuse with the site remedy and bona fide prospective purchaser liability protections. Bill and Phil will summarize all of the great support and tools that EPA provides to help facilitate successful Superfund site redevelopment. And lastly, I will share some final resources and contact information. Next slide. So first, what is the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, better known as SRI? SRI works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. It is important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be the most appropriate. Contaminated sites pose unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, they can also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. Returning contaminated sites to productive use is an important part of EPA's mission. The Superfund Task Force has developed recommendations for action and is diligently working to see the goals realized. If you're interested in finding out more about the task force, feel free to check out the link in the resources pod on the right side of your screen. For more information about SRI's reuse and redevelopment efforts, I would encourage you to visit the SRI website. The link to the SRI website is here on the slide and also listed in your resources pod on the right side of your screen. The two photos shown here, the first pictured on the left is the Strother Field Industrial Park Superfund site in Kansas. Here, there were several commercial and industrial businesses are located. Businesses there employ over 1,300 people and generate over $128 million in annual sales. Pictured on the right is the restored habitat at the Onondaga Lakes Superfund site in New York, which helps to provide resources needed for a sustainable ecosystem. More than 250 wildlife species are now found on the site, including more than 120 bird species. An outdoor amphitheater is funded by state and local resources and was constructed in 2015 as part of a lakefront revitalization effort. Next slide. I encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page also on the SRI website to learn more about specific organizations that have partnered with SRI to assist in Superfund site reuse. Collaborating with these organizations helps SRI provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. SRI currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and also the Pollinator Partnership. These organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with communities, municipalities, or other stakeholders to explore reuse opportunities and resources for their local Superfund sites. One final note, please feel free to ask questions of our presenters. We will have some time at the end for the remaining questions. And with that, I will turn things over to Bill Denman.
Thank you, Frank. Really appreciate that intro, and I want to welcome everybody here to the webinar as well. Let you know my name is Bill Denman. As Frank said, I'm chief of the Redevelopment and Chemicals Branch in the Land Chemicals and Redevelopment Division in Region 4, which is the Southeast region. We have the 8 southeastern states where we manage all of the EPA programs there. And what I have in the branch that I currently manage is the Brownfields Redevelopment Program, the pesticides program, sustainability, and PCB cleanups. But a lot of my background in the redevelopment of contaminated properties has to do with my time that I spent almost 20 years as a Superfund project manager, and is where I got to work on this site. And so I'm very happy to be able to talk with you all today and to present with these presenters. You have a real wealth of experience here. All of us, I believe, have been working in this Superfund redevelopment initiative since it began in 1999. So as most of you probably know, the Superfund, the law that is Superfund, which is the acronym of CERCLA, was passed in 1980. And for the first 15 years or so, EPA focused on getting sites on the national priorities list, cleaning up some of the worst sites that were out there. And it was all focused on investigation and cleanup and getting that done. Well, after about 15 years, as the program advanced and matured, we realized that there was another component that we were really leaving out of the equation, and that was the future use of the property. Why were we cleaning this up? What impact was our cleanup having on how these properties could be used in the future, and why that mattered to us? And so we'll be going over some of that today. And that is really when the Brownfields program began, was in the mid-1990s as a pilot, and then by 2002, Congress actually changed the Superfund law to codify the Brownfields program and provide some of the liability protections that we'll be talking about. And so as the Superfund program evolved, we began to be more concerned about the future use of the property, and that led to the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and where we are today. I started working in the Superfund program in 1997, so it was really a perfect time to be a project manager that was interested in future use of property, and that's what I began working on the site that we'll talk about today in the case study. So you might be asking yourself, well, why on earth would someone want to buy a Superfund site, right? I mean, this is the heavy hand of EPA, the enforcement program that can require individuals to conduct and pay for all of a cleanup. Why would somebody be interested in that? Well, it's just like any other real estate transaction. It's the location. And I believe when Janet talks to us, she can confirm this, but I believe one of the main things that she was interested in our case study project was the location of this property, and that was what initially attracted her to it, and then she began working with us on how it could be redeveloped. So I think it's important, and I think one of the issues that Superfund had was because of the liability scheme that is in Superfund law, not only was the fact that sites listed on the national priorities list, not only did it inhibit the redevelopment of that property, but had kind of a hole in the donut effect of properties around it. And so EPA began to realize that, and that's why a lot of these tools and resources were developed to try to promote and encourage redevelopment of these properties as they were cleaned up. So what are some of the other reasons that EPA may be interested and others may be interested in redeveloping contaminated property and Superfund sites included is conserving green space. There have been studies conducted that show that on average about 4.5 acres of greenfields are protected for every acre of contaminated property that's redeveloped, and that is because it prevents the concept of suburban sprawl and people moving out to greenfields to do redevelopment and all of the land that is taken up in that. And it revitalizes communities, and we've seen that in many cases local governments will have contaminated properties valued at near nothing, or maybe it's even abandoned, and so they're not collecting any property taxes on it. There's not any revenue coming in for the community that can be used to pay for roads and schools and things like that. So not only can redeveloping properties have an impact on helping blighted communities, but can also help those local governments. The picture at the top here is a picture of the old Camilla wood treating site in Camilla, Georgia, which is in kind of south central Georgia, which was eventually turned into a soccer complex that served several counties in the area. And we gave that site an award several years ago, and I was down there with the project manager who had worked on it, and he noticed that the homes around this site looked a lot better than when he worked there. He said, you know, the yards are cleaner, people have painted their houses, the whole community looks better. And it was true that people were taking more pride in their community now that this central blighted piece of property had been cleaned up, and you know, they had these nice soccer fields. There was more and more pride in that area. And the photo on the bottom is the one that's the Solatron microwave site. That's the topic of our case study. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. So what are we talking about when we talk about the universe of contaminated properties? Well, specifically today, we're going to be talking about the 40,000 plus or so Superfund sites, and this includes the National Priorities List sites, which is a very small subset. Under 1,700 sites are actually on the National Priorities List, but there have been a lot of properties that have been addressed by the Emergency Response and Removal Program under Superfund, and therefore have a potential Superfund liability. And so there are a lot of sites, even though they may not be National Priority List sites or sites listed on the National Priorities List, like the one in our case study, they may have been had an action that was taken under CERCLA, under the Superfund law, and may have potential Superfund liability. There are also about 3,700 sites that are covered by the RCRA program, and you know, RCRA is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, for those of you who may not know that, but that program is primarily delegated to states, but that is the cleanup program for operating facilities. And we won't be talking about those today, but those are also contaminated properties that do undergo redevelopment. The vast majority of contaminated or potentially contaminated properties out there are what are called brownfields. Brownfields are properties that there is either real or perceived contamination there that may be covered under CERCLA or under Superfund law. And that includes up to over 500,000 properties that may have some sort of underground storage tank, which is a big issue that we deal with. And when you look at brownfields in general and contaminated properties, we're talking about as much as $2 trillion and 5 million acres of undervalued real estate. So the economic impact of getting these properties back into productive use is just enormous. And these properties impact us all. I mean, over half of the U.S. population lives within 3 miles of one of these types of properties. So that brings us to our case study, which I'm very excited to talk about. This is a nice trip down memory lane for me, and hopefully it is for Janet. I know it is for Kat and I. And you know, we're going to talk today about the Solatron Microwave Superfund site. So by Superfund site, I mean this is a site that was on the National Priorities List. For those of you who are familiar with Superfund, this is what we call a fund lead site, or a site that was funded by EPA cleanup fund. So the potentially responsible party for this was not a viable party, so the EPA funds were being used to clean up this property. And so we're going to talk about this, and so you've already met me. We also have on the line Janet Kozan, who's CEO of Paradise Properties of Florida, which is the company that holds the property, which was subdivided up into several different parcels, and some of those have since been sold off. And then Cat West, who's currently with SCIO Solutions, a contractor to EPA, but at the time Cat was an attorney here in Region 4, and she was the site attorney on this site, and I was the project manager. And so, like I said, you have over 20 years each of us, including Janet, with experience in Superfund and specifically redevelopment of Superfund property. And I'm sure Janet could easily be a remedial project manager in the Superfund program now after having gone through this, because we learned a lot over this time. So, Gene, if I could have the arrow here, I'll point to a few things. This is a picture of the abandoned Solatron microwave building in Port Salerno, Florida. This building was, you can see in the back here, this is after we had conducted our removal action that we were conducting under the record of decision that we had signed for the site. This was an area in the back where treated wastewater had been disposed of and had leaked out and caused contamination of perchloroethylene and trichloroethylene. Solatron Microwave was an electronics manufacturer, and so they cleaned their the products that they made, the microwave parts, with PCE and TCE, and so they had that wastewater stream. And as you can see, it was a big building. A lot of activity occurred there. This is about a 20-acre piece of property, and this building was sitting right in the center of it. It had been there for quite a while. This is actually a tree growing out of the roof, out of the ceiling, on the top of the building. In fact, this property was so dilapidated and overgrown that at one point, when I first started working on the site, I was on the property trying to find some flush-mounted monitoring wells in some area like this that was way overgrown. And any of you in the business know how easy it is for flush-mounted monitoring wells to disappear when an area is allowed to grow over. And so I'd been there quite a while looking for it, and then I came back out to the road where my car was parked at the gate. And as I walked around the gate, there was a TV crew there, and the lights hit me in the face, and they said, "So, did you find the body?" And so I asked them, I said, what on earth are you talking about? And apparently someone in the area had disappeared, and because my car had government plates, they thought I was with the FBI or something, and that I had been searching for the body. And the news crew just assumed that this property, which they had, you know, reported so many things, bad things had happened, that this is where, you know, we would go to look for it. And so inside the building, there were just loads and loads of broken beer bottles and graffiti on the wall, and occasionally there would be people living in the building. And it was right in the center of a residential area, and kind of a low to middle income residential area. And so it was a real eyesore for people around there. And you know, we as EPA, we can clean the site up, but we can't redevelop it. And one other thing to point out is underneath the building where the operations occurred, there had been some spills too. And so there was some low-level contamination in the soil underneath the building. And the water table here was about 12 or 13 feet. So we decided when we wrote the record of decision to just leave the building there as a cap, that the contaminated soil underneath wasn't really worth tearing the building down to get to. And that we would leave an institutional control on the property, and that becomes important as Janet came in with her redevelopment and raised this building. We were able to get to that, and it greatly enhanced our remedy and allowed us to have a completely clean closure once the groundwater is cleaned up. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kat, who, as we're working through this in the record of decision, you know, Kat is the site attorney on it, and as Janet approached us and was interested in purchasing the property, Kat was working with the non-viable but liable, potentially responsible party on settlement and on disposition of the property. So Kat, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Well, thank you, Bill, and I had forgotten about that story about the body, so thank you for remembering. That is funny. Well, it's so nice that it feels like the band is back together, having you and Janet on the call today. And I have this photo up because I think that this is probably how some developers and local governments feel when they learn that the property, this perfect property in this perfect location that they want to purchase and redevelop, and they find out that it's a Superfund site, and they're like, oh. And I'm pretty sure this is how Janet felt back in 2002 when she was interested in the Solatron Microwave site. But here's the really good news, and I can't emphasize this enough, is that Superfund sites are truly fabulous redevelopment opportunities. And you might ask why, and as Bill was mentioning, well, location for sure, and oftentimes, you know, they have access to great infrastructure. But they're also fabulous redevelopment opportunities because of the availability of really strong liability protections, really good EPA support, and a whole suite of tools to make these redevelopment opportunities a tremendous success. And so in this webinar, we're going to peel back the onion a bit, and we're going to talk about many of those. So let's talk about the Brownfield Amendment. So 2002 was a great year. It was a great year for Brazil because they won the World Cup, and it was a great year for Burgundy wines, or so I'm told by Google. But most importantly, 2002 was a great year for Superfund redevelopment. And this is when things got really exciting. And that's because in 2002, Congress created a brand new liability protection for prospective purchasers of Superfund sites. And this new liability protection is known as bona fide prospective purchaser status, BFPP for short. And it was created as part of the Brownfield Amendment to the Superfund law. And this new bona fide prospective purchaser, or BFPP status liability protection was and still is a very big deal. And you'll hear more about this later from Phil Page. But for now, know that the BFPP status and the Brownfield Amendments really set the stage for a significant increase in the pace of Superfund site redevelopment all across the country. But there was a problem. And back in 2002, developers and local governments who were encouraged by the new liability protections in the Brownfield Amendments we're starting to contact EPA with increased frequency about redeveloping the Superfund sites, you know, in their community. And I can tell you, Bill and I were thrilled, really excited about all the interest and all the calls. However, EPA at the time had really no way, no process of effectively or efficiently managing these inquiries and requests for support on redevelopment. And sadly, the result back then was that these awesome redevelopment opportunities were just getting lost in the shuffle. And, you know, we found that some either inconsistent or sometimes non-existent information about, you know, the site cleanup, the redeveloper's plans for redeveloping the site, and just a general lack of understanding and comfort with the new liability protections was slowing things down too much. And we all know that time is money. And so a lot of opportunities were just getting lost. But luckily, lightning struck in the form of a very serendipitous phone call from Janet Kozan, a Florida developer extraordinaire. And Janet had discovered that the property, the Solatron Microwave property that she wanted to purchase and redevelop, was undergoing, you know, an EPA cleanup. And so she called Bill Venman about the site. And as Bill mentioned, I just happened to be the EPA Region 4 attorney assigned to the site, and I really love redevelopment and was really getting involved. And so Bill and I had the perfect opportunity to co-create something called the Prospective Purchaser Inquiry Tool. And it's also affectionately known as the PPI process. The PPI tool or process, we really designed it to maximize redevelopment opportunities. And so when a developer or, say, a local government, a municipality called EPA wanting information or support, through this tool, EPA now had a formal process to help, which was fast and it was highly effective. Developers and local government just loved it in Region 4. And so once we started using the prospective purchaser inquiry process, redevelopment in Region 4 took off like a rocket. It was so much fun to be a part of it and to watch it happen. And we're going to talk a lot more about the PPI tool later and how you might be able to use it. But first, Janet, as the developer at the Solitaire Microwave site, do you mind sharing with us why you chose the site and like what your experience was developing the site and working with EPA?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay. I just didn't know. I had done everything correctly. Yes, this is Janet Kozan. I'm president of Port Salerno Industrial Park currently. However, back in November of 2002, my partner and I, Larry Vienz, were looking for an investment property in the Palm Beach or Martin County area. We stumbled upon this property off of Cove Road, and it is in the northern part of Martin County, and we saw this peculiar sign. And on this sign, it said Superfund Redevelopment Site. We really had no idea what that meant. And so my partner Larry called, and he told us it was a contaminated property by a prior owner who was the Solitron Microwave company that did electric plating to miniature microwave parts, and actually started back as early as 1968 through 1987. And later it was taken over by another retrofitting company that did electric plating for the aerospace program. It was contaminated with three specific chemicals, vinyl chloride, perchloroethylene, and dichloroethylene. Again, I knew nothing about any of the chemicals or how horrible it was when it got into the soil and the water aquifer. So when my partner told me, I immediately said, oh, we don't want to have anything to do with that. And I was scared to death due to probably 90% of ignorance. However, being the curious cat that I am, I called and investigated and did some reading and shared with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection and, of course, Martin County, the county in which the property was located. I was informed that the Florida Department of Environmental Protection and EPA were partnering to clean up the land, which the EPA was already there sampling soils and addressing the public water supply system. I found out that they were going to replace 150 homes off of their wells and put them on public drinking water to protect them from the plume that was coming from our property. At that point, I was so motivated by the Greenspan wave of philosophy that Martin County had going on at that time. And I was so grateful to see that the EPA really actually cared enough about our little community to come in and purify it. I decided with my partner that we would purchase the property and that we would go along with any of the requirements that EPA had for us so that we could make it a successful redevelopment. One of the things that I loved was, like Kat said, was the strong liability protection that they had for future and potential purchasers. As I had decided, or my partner and I made a game plan to develop this 20 acres into seven individual lots for office warehouse, light industrial use, if you will. And so we had a land developer and an engineer draw up the site plan. And, you know, we kind of got an idea of what we were going to do before we even bought the property. But the fact that Cat West and Bill Denman had what we called the PPA, Prospective Purchaser Agreement, and then later it became Covenant Not to Sue, and we were told that we would present these to the future buyers, the potential buyers of our lots, and that would protect them from any liability of the contamination that was already there. Again, I thought this was a very ingenious way to redevelop and to get properties back into use. I was impressed with the organization of Bill and Kat in the whole US EPA system for renovating these properties. I felt very comfortable the whole step of the way until I was finally comfortable enough to close on the property March 2003. Okay, so we made our purchase in March of 2003, and everybody would probably want to know why not that I chose a Superfund site. There's several reasons that all potential buyers that want to renovate these properties should know. One, first of all, most counties are so excited about you helping them get rid of this contamination, they will offer you discounts on your ad valorem taxes, as we got for the first 5 years of owning the property. Also, they waived impact fees for about the first three or four properties that we sold, saved us literally thousands of dollars, $50,000 to $60,000 on impact fees. In our new purchasers, we were able to pass that savings on to them as they purchased the different lots. We also got expedited approvals from the county for people to get their plans approved and submitted and get a permit a little quicker than if you were not buying from the Superfund site. We also noticed we got a lot of free advertising. EPA awarded us a Superfund award down the road once we got started, and we had a big meeting and shindig out there on the property, on the site, with the news reporters and then the local TV channels, and so you got a lot of free marketing, so to speak, for, you know, buying the Superfund site. So that was also a very nice little perk that we weren't aware of when we bought the property. Then you also, last but not least, got a very good price in purchasing a Superfund site. The real estate was discounted way more than if it had been a non-Superfund site. And, you know, I think really the icing on the cake was working with the EPA and working with people like Bill Dimon and Kat West, because they were so knowledgeable and so helpful. And it wasn't just words that they told you before you bought it, but it was follow-up and actually paperwork that they provided for us after we purchased the property. So they also asked us to have certain guidelines that we told our new purchasers, like no heavy industry, no disposing of contamination in the soil, and a lot of things like, you know, the vapor, this queen under their buildings and things like that, that we required when they did build and that we required when they were doing their business. And we still check on that from time to time to make sure there's not a gas tank leaking or anything in the on the property that would be adverse to what our cleanup program was about. So that being said, why did I choose a Superfund site? I kind of just happened upon it. And how did I choose a Superfund site? I was looking for a good deal on some real estate. And am I glad that I did choose a Superfund site? Yes, I certainly was. I am very happy the whole way. I never regretted it. I was never sorry I had closed on this property. And I'm almost finished with the development of it. I've got one more. Well, all the lots are sold. I'm building a building on one of the lots myself, and I've got two more buildings under construction right now. So, well, I would say within the next 18 months, the entire industrial park will be completed. So that being said, would I do anything differently? No, I think I'd probably just not. I would do what they call mitigate wetlands. I had a lot of wetlands on the property, which has nothing to do with the contamination. but it had to do with the way Florida likes to preserve their natural habitats for, you know, eco life, if you will. And I could have mitigated those, and I won't go into what that means, mitigation, but I would have had more land to probably use for development. But other than that, there was nothing that EPA did that I regretted. And Martin County was also pretty helpful, I'll have to say that. So I don't know. I think that's pretty much everything I have to say. It was a really good experience, and I would highly recommend anybody else that had any kind of doubts about purchasing a Superfund site, I would say don't worry one bit and just go ahead and purchase it and redevelop it, and I think you'll be really glad you did. And they're welcome to call me anytime. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Janet. That was so nice of you to offer that, and I'll have to say, you know, first of all, Janet was fantastic to work with. I mean, you always called us back. You always, you know, were interested in trying to really understand where we were coming from. Sometimes, you know, and you know, I know it's easy for us to paint a great picture here and how great things went. Sometimes we would have to call you with things that come up, and we'd have to work through them. Well, how are we going to address this? And you were just so understanding and cooperative and, you know, understanding our position as well and what we had to do. And we, you know, tried to understand, you know, what your position was. And I think, you know, being able to meet in the middle was just great. And just to give you a few examples, you know, we had monitoring wells already on the property. And, you know, as you can see from the picture there, the building was right in the middle of the property. And when Janet decided that, well, I can't really reuse this building, I'm going to have to tear it down, and, you know, I want to really build a little road in and have a cul-de-sac and then, you know, parcel these properties off, she designed the road to be, and the cul-de-sac turn part to be over the area of greatest contaminated groundwater, and she designed the lot lines for the parcels to the extent she could to align where our monitor well clusters were. And so I think we wound up maybe relocating one well that would have been right in the center of one of the buildings, but we probably had 30 wells out there. And so, you know, working with her, we were able to have those within the lot lines between the different parcels. And that was really a big deal for us because, you know, as all of, you know, I'm sure a lot of the people on the phone today are environmental professionals. They know how important it is to have repeatable data from monitoring wells so that you can establish trends and look at how things are happening over time. And so we really appreciated that, and that really helped minimize the impact on us. And you know, and we worked through things like, you know, when we did our first monitoring well sampling round, we delivered a bunch of IDW drums that were put out right in your cul-de-sac, and as you were trying to sell, you know, buildings, and, you know, you called us and like, do you really have to put them there? And so, yeah, you're right, that was a good point. So we moved them around, you know, back where they weren't quite so, you know, nobody wants to drive in and see 40 empty drums sitting there. It's like, what's this, you know? So so we, you know, we really tried to work with you, and you were certainly great to work with us. And I think, you know, that was key in this being so successful. You know, as well, Kat said, yeah, this was, I'm sorry, Janet, go ahead. Did you?
No, it was just, I felt like we had a lucky land planner too, the engineer that we had, you know, do this, a civic engineer, and I think he was also sensitive to redeveloping Superfunds and being, you know, green to the community. And the one building that you see that's sitting down there now is the building that I'm constructing at this time. It will be a 23,000 square foot building. And we should employ anywhere from 15 to 25 people. And I believe the park total will have, you know, close to 100 people working there. So we did like the idea that we'd be creating new jobs as well.
That's just fantastic. I mean, that's, you know, that's, as we clean up these properties, we have to look at, you know, what the future use can be, you know, so that they can be put back into productive use, not just, you know, to help out the community, but to help out the local government. And this property was such a success in increasing the taxable amount that the county would receive from it that the newspaper did did an article on it. And the title of the article, there was another site being redeveloped in Martin County, so there were two Superfund sites in Martin County, both undergoing redevelopment at the same time. The title of the article was Superfund Sites Boon to Martin County. And the article talked about how the appraised value, I think, of this property, which was $265,000, even at this time, this was back in 2006, the appraised value had been raised to $1 million. Maybe not great news to you, Janet, but for the because your taxable value of it was higher, but certainly for the county, you know, this was a property that they'd had to respond to calls on of, you know, bad things happening there and trying to, you know, keep it safe for the people who live around there, but they also weren't collecting any revenue from it that they could use to pay for county services. So they're just such a
That's absolutely
such a
correct.
Here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is there. Absolutely correct. Yeah.
And well, I know, you know, Janet mentioned, you know, one of the other benefits of redeveloping this site. For any of you who have worked in Florida, you know that things like to grow there. In fact, you know, as an EPA person, if I ever see land where nothing's growing, that's always a concern, right? You know, if something's not growing on it. And, you know, this property, having been left vacant for so long, was just loaded with Melaleuca and Brazilian pepper and other invasives. And, you know, as part of the redevelopment plan that the county had to approve for Janet to move forward, like she said, she had to take out all of the invasive plants, and she had to include a certain buffer of native Florida plants. And so it really improved the environment there as far as even though it's, you know, buildings and roads and stuff, it's also now native Florida plants and all instead of these invasives that had pretty much taken over.
Exactly. Good point.
Yeah. So,
true.
So I guess, you know, looking at takeaways, and Janet, feel free to jump in and add any from any information on this, but over-communication was good. I think, you know, we talked a lot. We when anything came up, good or bad or whatever, I made sure that, you know, we talked to each other about it, and we kept, you know, good working relationship, either, you know, going down there and meeting if we needed to, or, you know, talking over the phone or doing whatever we needed to do to help resolve. Creating synergies between cleanup and reuse as early as possible was a huge, huge benefit. You know, Janet, I think you originally looked at maybe repurposing the building briefly, and then when you decided not to, you let us know that you were tearing it down, and that allowed us to start moving forward to get the funding available so that when you tore the building down, which you did at your expense, we were there to excavate the soil with EPA funds underneath the building that had low-level some contamination in it that was not a direct contact threat for those environmental professionals out there, but a potential exposure to groundwater threat. So, so we were able to do that. Maximizing the win-win
And you did it in a very expeditious manner. It wasn't like you held up our development. You were always right there with the perfect timing so we could move forward and not lose a lot of time in doing our development. That was what was so great.
That's an excellent point. I mean, I've been involved with redevelopment of a lot of sites, and I've seen, you know, situations where, you know, ditches were filled in, and then they were, you know, then they were, or ditches were cleaned out, and then they were immediate, you know, then a month later they were come back, they were filled in, and, you know, maybe excavated areas were filled in, but the soil wasn't compacted, so you had to pull it back. You know, when the developer came in, they had to pull the soil out and compact the soil, and, you know, so we really did try to work together so that, you know, we could keep things moving forward, and we didn't hold that up. So I appreciate you saying that. We've tried really hard to do that. And as any of you out there in the government know that, you know, that's not always easy because it's not like we necessarily have this, you know, funds available to just go at any time because you have to have the funds, you have to have approved work plans, you have to have, you know, a contractor ready to go. And so, you know, by communicating, we were able to do that.
We had great communication. You were always down here, you know, checking out anything that we were concerned about. And I understand in any kind of a government situation, the red tape and bureaucracy of paperwork takes time and does tend to sometimes get a little extensive, and it's, you know, can be frustrating for those of us that own our own business. But I didn't see that with you guys in your department.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. We worked really hard to try to keep things going. I think, you know, communicating, we talked a lot with Martin County as well. Like Janet said, we part of the remedy was we extended water lines to the surrounding community so that people could go off wells and go into public water. You know, so people kind of saw this as a as an overall, you know, the even though that was a, an EPA part of the cleanup, people saw all this happening and this property being put back into, you know, being cleared and being, you know, having jobs and being taken care of as a as an overall benefit. And I haven't been down there in a while, Janet. From what I understand, there's a lot of development that has happened around down Cove Road on other pieces of property.
There absolutely has, Bill, and I know earlier when you mentioned middle to lower socioeco development in that area, I think the whole area, not just because of us, but because there's been encouragement of other development all around the site, has raised the actual level to a middle to upper middle, you know, class socioeco living, if you will.
Well, that's
so
good,
it has raised the bar.
One of the issues at the time was that a lot of people were on wells because that was the older part of Port Salerno, and as the county grew, you know, the areas that were growing, the newer areas were the ones that got public water and everything else, and this was an area that the county had, you know, been looking at trying to come back in and extend public water to, and so, you know, part of the cleanup of this overall cleanup plan of this site helped spur that, and Martin County was just fantastic to work with. They were they actually used what we did and more than doubled it using county funds to make sure that everybody in the community would have access to public water, and that was just a great experience working with them as well. So I think,
yeah,
you know,
it definitely improved that neighborhood. We put the 150 water wells in. That neighborhood definitely appreciated after that too.
Yes, yes. No, I think they needed it. Being a good, you know, problem solver, I think, you know, it's any redevelopment project like this is a leap of faith for, you know, Janet, you know, people like Janet who are putting their money on the line, that are putting their investment on the line. It's a leap of faith for us because we're working with somebody. This a lot of times isn't what EPA is used to doing. But I think, you know, being a problem solver to try to address issues as they come up and put them out there. Don't hold them back because they just get worse if you don't bring them up and, you know, figure out how to solve them and how to move forward. And then utilizing our available tools, I think we'll talk about those at the end. But as Kat said, we have a tremendous array of tools that have been developed over time that can help. And so I believe that's our next topic. So, Janet, did you have anything else you wanted to mention? Or we'll move on to Phil's part.
No, Bill, I'm good, and I'm enjoyed the webinar very much. I may have to, in about 5 or 10 minutes, disconnect, but I just want to let you know, thank you so much for including me.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for participating. I hope it's been beneficial for everyone to have the real-world developer there, and we can talk about how great we think it is, but, you know, you're the one that actually thought it out and saw it through you know, well, one other thing I wanted to mention, I think every time I met you there, Janet, you were picking up things around. This is a 20-acre piece of property, and you'd see Janet way over in the corner picking up a plastic bag that had blown in off the road or pulling up a Melaleuca that had sprouted since you. I mean, you had that property looking great every time we were down there, and so you're definitely a good steward in many ways. So,
well, I'm still doing that, too.
I'm not surprised. So I guess maybe if it's okay with the speakers, maybe since Janet has to jump off here soon, would it be a good time now to see if anyone had questions for her before she has to leave us? Jean and Frank, you guys are looking at the questions.
Sure, there was. I'm going to jump in here just for Frank. I know he's having a computer issue. So there was a question that came in for Janet. People were interested in the mechanics of who she actually bought the property from.
Well, I actually bought the property from Solatron Microwave, the company that owned it at that time, but they were under strict scrutiny with EPA and Florida Department of Environmental Protection. They were being forced into doing certain things, and I guess they just didn't want to spend the money. So I bought it from Solatron. Yeah.
And I can just add to that. So what we were doing is EPA had a lien against the property, and so as the transaction happened, EPA, you know, received the funds from the sale to help offset some of Solitron Microwave's liability, and I believe DEP did some as well. Kat, do you remember any more about that?
Yeah, I think the company was insolvent and had either gone through a bankruptcy or was going through a bankruptcy. So they're really their only asset was the property. And so through the property transaction that Janet was mentioning, we were able to have the funds come to EPA, and EPA then applied that to the cleanup. So it really was a win-win for the redevelopment and for the community.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I was very delighted about, was that probably over $1 million went in from the EPA to the cleanup, and I really didn't have to spend too terribly much money on the cleanup other than the, I think I spent about maybe $40,000-$50,000 raising or demolishing the 80,000-square-foot building.
Yeah, and this is Kat again. That's really the beauty of Superfund redevelopment, is that the redeveloper has the option to help with the cleanup, you know, to expedite it, to maybe take it to a different level if they want residential. But they don't have to do that under the liability protections. But it's always a good partnership. If we can identify the reuse early in the cleanup, the synergies are just amazing, and often we can get a faster, cheaper, and really a better cleanup if we're able to work with the redeveloper early.
Absolutely.
Okay, were there any other questions?
Well, I just think in the interest of time, we might have to move on to the next portion. So, Frank, are we ready to move on to the next segment?
Yes.
Okay, so the next segment is mine. My name is Phil Page. I am an attorney in the Office of Site Remediation and Enforcement in EPA headquarters, and I've been working on this sort of thing for about 15 years and have had the good fortune of working with most of the people on the phone, and I think a few who are calling in. So, and also, Bill, in a prior life, I was an FBI agent, and I did find the bodies. So,
Oh, wow. So it wasn't too strange that they were asking me if I had found one then.
Yeah, well, from that side, there probably should have been some there. I don't know. So I want to talk a little bit about the PPI tool that was developed by Kat and Bill pursuant to this particular case, and then highlight kind of where we are today, because that was developed in 2002. It was one of the – it was the first systematic process to identify issues with a site that needed to be redeveloped. And the tool offers a prospective purchaser fast, accurate, and comprehensive information to enable them, as well as the EPA, to make a decision as to how this site could be redeveloped. It's a one-stop shopping for information. And this is important not only for the prospective purchaser, because, as was mentioned several times in the previous dialogue, for redevelopers, time is money, and so they want to get something done quickly and accurately and as fast as they can. But redevelopers need to understand that taking care of contamination takes some time and takes some thought. And if they do it in a way that is haphazard and maybe causes more contamination, then they themselves may be liable for that contamination. But that's where the BFPP issue comes in, and I'll get to that in a second. But the PPI tool, again, kind of developed by Region 4, is used to streamline the process, not only for Region 4, but also for the prospective purchasers. And that last point, it helps to inform the prospective purchasers of all of the revitalization tools that are available. And there are a number of those, and we will go over those a little bit more later in this presentation. So I want to go over the Region 4 PPI tool. And as Kat and Bill pointed out, they had to this was something new. And so they were developing something basically out of nothing to deal with this new issue of redeveloping Superfund sites. And so the basis for their tool is what's the site status and compatibility. And site status and compatibility are two issues that Bill will talk about in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. There's also liability protection and lien and title issues, and I'll touch base on those a little bit more also in the next few minutes. But what I wanted to do is just highlight how it works in Region 4, and Bill and Kat, jump in here if I get something wrong. But basically, when a call comes in from a Janet, and you know, they call Bill or Kat or whomever is in those positions now, and they say, hey, I'm interested in this site. What do I need to know about it? Region 4 assembles a team consisting of the SRI coordinator, the Superfund site attorney, the remedial project manager, which is what Bill was, Kat was the site attorney there, and potentially other people who may need to be involved with that. Often in Superfund cases, there's a community involvement coordinator, and you have to bring that person in. There may be some other folks, EJ, environmental justice coordinators, and you bring them in too. But the Region 4 developed a team, and so this team would get on the phone and or meet with the developer, the Janets of the world, and talk to him or her about the site. And the first issue that they talked about was the site status. You know, what's the nature of the contamination? Where's the contamination? How far along is the cleanup? All of those things which they need to know, they being EPA, as well as the redeveloper needs to know. And again, the PPI tool is a great tool to provide information for both sides. So they discuss that. The second issue in a discussion would be what the proposed use would be. So in this Solartron case, the proposed use was not for residential use. It was for business use, industrial use. And so that's part of the site assessment, and they have to decide what the future anticipated use of the site's going to be. And there's a lot that goes into that decision-making process, not only within the EPA, but also within the community, the county or the city where the site's located. Those folks need to be involved to understand, okay, here's the site, here's there's a groundwater issue, whatever it is, and the community makes that decision, oh, we're going to only use this for business or industrial or light industry or whatever it may be. So the second issue is what the proposed use is. And again, that was discussed pretty extensively in the last conversation. The third issue, and this is one I'll talk about a little bit more later, is the liability protections. There's a series of liability protections that Kat mentioned in the Brownfield Amendments of 2002, and we still call them the amendments, even though it's been around for 17 years now. But in the Brownfield Amendments of 2002, as Kat mentioned, they established the BFPP protection. And I'll go into that a little bit more, but there are certain criteria that a bona fide prospective purchaser must meet in order to get liability protection. And liability protection means here, and this is very critical, that the VFPP cannot be sued for cleanup or cost recovery by either the EPA or, and perhaps more importantly, third parties. And so that's very important. A lot of times developers will come in and they really do trust the EPA not to sue them, but they can't trust other potentially responsible parties or PRPs at a site to sue. So by complying with the brownfields VFPP provisions, they get some liability protection. And then there's the issue of liens. There are a couple different liens. I'll go over those a little bit more in detail a little bit later, but there's the lien that Bill mentioned in the last session, and that's a CERCLA 107. That's the section of CERCLA L lien, which is basically a lien for money. It's like a lien that a carpenter would have on a house to get paid for that. When we clean up something, we can put a lien on it. There's a different type of lien that also came about as a result of the Brownfield Amendments, and that's called the windfall lien. I'll, again, touch base with that a little bit more in a second or two on that. So the purpose, again, for the PPI, and again, this was such a great tool that Region 4 developed, is to provide timely information so that both sides, EPA and the redeveloper, can make a informed business decision as to what is needed to be accomplished at the site in order to make it a viable, marketable, cleaned up Superfund site. So it's a very important tool, and it is also the tool that provided the platform for a nationwide PPI tool. In 2 years ago, in 2017, the administrator established a Superfund task force, and the task force was identified to and charged with identifying ways to speed up the cleanup of the Superfund sites. One of those suggestions was to develop a way to get the site from the initial contact from a redeveloper to the EPA, and in this case from Janet to Bill, to clean up and in the quickest time possible. And so we took the Region 4 PPI tool and enhanced it and developed a few more lines of question based on, you know, 20 years of experience now on that. And we have developed that tool, and it is now out there. It's now out there in the regions, and it's an internal tool for the use of the regions, but the purpose is still the same, to help inform the regions as well as developers as to the condition of a site and what needs to be done to get that site into productive reuse. And so the core of the inquiry tool is a series of suggested discussion topics to guide EPA regions as they analyze information necessary to move the site into reuse, into productive reuse. And again, just hats off to Region 4 for thinking outside the box 17, 18 years ago and providing the platform for a national tool that is used today by all of the regions. So with that, I will turn it back over to Bill, who will give a little bit more information on the site status and compatibility concepts used in the PPI process. Bill?
Oh, thanks, Phil. That was a great discussion about the PPI tool, and it just really warms my heart to see it, hear it described by someone else, and because Kat and I talked about it for years, and I'm just so happy that it's continued on and that people find it useful. And, you know, we talk about time being money for developers, but I heard it put another way by a developer one time, and he said that time is the killer of all deals. And I think that's really true when we look at timeliness. And so this tool really helps us get back with them on a timely basis. And our internal schedule for one of these, when somebody got a call, was to within 5 days assemble the team and have a call, and then within 2 weeks have a comfort letter out. And so, that was really good information for people to be able to make that decision. So I'm going to talk about the first two, which is the current status of the site and then compatibility. And so the first two things we talked about, as Phil said, was the site status, and that's where we would have the RPM talk or the Superfund project manager talk about, we have a record of decision, we're moving forward with trying to get funds for design, we should implement the remedy in 1 to 2 years, something like that. Well, we think we're going, or even if we didn't have a record of decision signed, we would say, well, this is primarily groundwater contamination we're dealing with. There is a small area where there's soil contamination. We'll have to excavate that probably. We may do some in situ treatment, but this area, can't be redeveloped. But a lot of times, you may have a 100-acre piece of property and only 10 acres that was the area that, was contaminated and being addressed. And so, a lot of times development, redevelopment could go ahead and start on other parts of the property. So having that initial discussion on the current status of the site provided the developer that information as to, well, am I looking at starting something right now, or is this a long-term investment for me, or, what is my time frame so that I can make that business decision over whether this property is a good deal for me or not. The second issue we talk about is what they plan to do with the property. And, this is where we say, okay, can you tell us a little bit about what your plans are? And sometimes people, are more forthcoming than others. Sometimes it's, kind of business confidential for them, and they don't want to share it with everybody. But most times people will tell us, oh, yeah, I want to build an office park, or I'm interested in, this is the kind of development that I do, and, I think this would work well for me. And an example of how this really works, and when Kat and I started doing this, our real goal wasn't necessarily to redevelop properties, but it's to provide that information so that people can make the decision on whether they want to move forward with purchasing this property or not. And an example of what we found a successful PPI call was only a 15-minute call. And we got to we talked about the first issue, the site status, and when we got to compatibility, we asked the caller, we said, well, what are you planning to do with the property? And this was actually the property that Janet later wound up purchasing and redeveloping, the one we talked about in the case study. And he said, well, I want to open a plant nursery. That's my business, and I have plant nurseries around Florida, and, I need a big piece of land that I can, put my plants are all above ground, they're in pots, but they're palm trees or, palm plants or whatever, and, I grow them and then sell them for people for landscaping. So I don't need to dig in the dirt. Okay, that's no problem. And so somebody asked him, they said, well, how do you plan to water these plants? And he said, well, I always sink a well and water them with groundwater. And that's when we said, well, that's going to be a problem here because the groundwater is contaminated. We don't have a real good idea yet of the extent of contamination, and withdrawing a large amount of water from the aquifer could potentially cause the groundwater flow past to change, or you could pull up contamination, and so we'd have to restrict groundwater use for now. And he said, oh, well, thank you so much. You saved me a lot of time and money by telling me that, and hung up the phone. In 15 minutes, we were off the call, but it was successful because this person who was interested in this piece of property had the information and had decided, this isn't going to work for me. I need a piece of property where I can use the groundwater. And so, the PP going through this discussion with everybody in the room at once really helps bring out those kinds of issues early so that we don't, all of us invest a lot of time into something that eventually is not going to wind up working anyway. And I guess another thing I would point out in the PPI tool and in talking about these, we did hundreds of these. This isn't just something we did a few times. Over the 10 or 15 years that I did them, we did, I'm certain, over 200. We would do two or three a month a lot of times on different pieces of property that people were interested in redeveloping. Or it could be an adjacent piece of property where the groundwater had migrated to, you know, in an industrial park to several different parcels, and we had groundwater monitoring wells, and that person was selling their property, and somebody saw the well, what's this for, you know, and they would want to talk with us about what their potential liability would be. And so we issued a ton of comfort letters. We did a lot of PPI calls, and, you know, understanding, first of all, where we're going with the cleanup and then what the potential future use is, in my mind, were two of the most important things before moving forward into our next one, which is the BFPP liability protections, which I'm going to turn back over to Phil to explain.
Okay, so we talked about the BFPP provision a couple different times, but again, this was a provision that was enacted in 2002 with the Brownfield Amendments. Congress recognized that it is important to redevelop these contaminated sites. And Bill mentioned because of location, location, location. Also, these sites are sitting fallow. Cities weren't getting any tax revenue off of them. And we recognized in the 90s that by redeveloping the sites, we could create jobs and permanent jobs and good jobs, and use a lot of the redevelopment actually in the cleanup process. So Congress paid attention, and they enacted the bona fide prospective purchaser provisions in CERCLA, the Superfund law, and those provisions have certain criteria, and let me get to that slide. So the first two criteria are threshold criteria. These are things that have to be done before a purchaser can even look at it. Site. You can't have a purchaser who's associated with the contaminating party, the PRP. And so we really look at that. And there, we have had sites where there have been spin-off companies who tried to purchase their own contaminated sites as a BFPP, and we go back through the history of the company, and we say, no, there's an affiliation issue here. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't work around some of those, but at least as a BFPP, you can't be affiliated. The second thing is the all-appropriate inquiries, and this is the basic historic due diligence. It's kind of due diligence on steroids, though. And so you have to understand what this property is. You have to understand if there's a sign that says remedial cleanup by EPA, you probably ought to call EPA and find out what the deal is with that. And if you call the regions now, they have this PPI tool that they can go through and give you the history of the site. The disposal has to occur before the purchase. So you can't go in there and then dispose of something and say, oh, I want the liability protection. So that's number three, and that's in purple. So it's a little bit – that's a different threshold criteria, but it's also a continuing criteria, quite frankly. The other five criteria are they're based on historic information and work that we did in the 90s, and Congress again took them and codified them into the law here. But you have to provide all legal required notices, take reasonable steps to prevent releases. That's a fairly important one. Provide access if the site's still not totally clean up. You have to provide access to either the potentially responsible party, the PRP, or to EPA who's cleaning it up. And you have to comply with institutional controls. You can't interfere with the cleanup. You can't move a well. You can't do those sort of things. And you have to comply with information requests from the EPA. So those are statutory criteria. All of those eight criteria must be complied with in order to get the liability protection. Now, the interesting thing about the BFPP provision in CERCLA is that it's self-implementing. So if you go through these criteria, you follow them, we, EPA, may not even know about these about the sale and purchase of a contaminated property. Some properties are so contaminated that we should know about them. But theoretically, if you comply as a BFPP with all of these criteria, you are protected from liability from either EPA or from third parties. So that's the great thing about the BFPP provisions within in CERCLA. So I want to just talk a little bit about windfall lien. The CERCLA provides for two different types of lien, the 107L lien and the 107R lien. The 107L lien is the one where we spend a lot of money cleaning it up, and we want to get that money back. The windfall lien that was provided for with the Brownfield Amendments provides for if we spend some money cleaning up a property and it significantly enhances the value of that property, then we can have a windfall lien to collect some of that difference between the price of the property is contaminated and the price that is cleaned up using taxpayer funds for that. So we can provide a 107, and it's called a 107R lien. They don't happen very often. Quite frankly, we have some guidance out on it. And so windfall liens do not happen very often. And so I just want to kind of assure folks that even if they do happen, we can kind of take care of them through some sort of agreement. The last thing I want to mention right now, and this is a recent change to Superfund law, and that's the BUILD Act. And the BUILD Act stands for Better Utilization of Investment Leading to Development. Now, Congress loves to have these acronyms to spell out acts that they can call by, oh, this is the BUILD Act. But the BUILD Act was fairly significant. One, it was the first amendment to CERCLA basically since the 2002 amendments. And it removed the involuntary requirements for liability protection for local and state governments. And there was a provision that local and state governments, if they acquired contaminated property, had to do it involuntarily. And the BUILD Act took that out. It expanded liability exemption for these state and local governments and added a new category of exempt acquisitions, and that category is through seizure or otherwise connection with law enforcement activity. So the states could or local governments could seize, pursuant to law enforcement activities, contaminated property but not be held liable as an owner and operator of that. It also, the BUILD Act also expanded the liability protection for long-term tenants or leasehold tenants, and it created a new liability protection for native villages and native corporations. And it also increased the grant, brownfield grant eligibility requirements. So, very significant, and I'm trying to hurry through this, BFPP protections, and then those protections were enhanced by the BUILD Act of 2018. So Bill and I will, once you use the BPI tool, it opens the door for a bunch of other liability protection tools, and Bill and I will discuss those at this point. So, Bill, you want to take over here?
Sure. Yeah, I'll come in, and yeah, I know we're getting close on time here. So, in the interest of time, we'll kind of go through these. What we've been talking about primarily today is the PPI tool. While very helpful, a couple things we didn't point out about it: there is no cost to a developer to do this. They can call in, and we'll be glad. It's just an information sharing for us. We want to, view it as our job to share information with people who may be interested in purchasing a contaminated piece of property. A couple of times I've had people thought it was required, so I just want to make sure that, there's no misunderstanding. This isn't required. The BFPP provisions to CERCLA were meant to be self-implementing, so we didn't have to get involved. So, you know, if it's straightforward and people feel like they understand it, there's no reason to do it. But, you know, it's always good to talk to us, I think, at least initially, to make sure there's not something that, you know, we don't understand. The primary tool that I think, at least in the beginning, is the top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site. You can do a web search for that that title, and it'll show up. That is a great document. It's one that Kat and I started way back when, and then OSRI and the program side of EPA issued it as a joint national guidance. So it's issued by both the enforcement side of EPA and the programmatic side of EPA, and that's significant because it contains both legal and programmatic information. That was meant to just be a kind of an initial primer to, you know, what you might want to think about if you're thinking about buying a Superfund site or a site that may become a Superfund site. Frank has a great website that he's developed nationally. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative website has links to all of these things, but there are fact sheets on there that show success stories, and they look at, we also have case studies and other things that, you know, depending on what your redevelopment is, because we've been doing this for so long, there's a likelihood that, you know, something similar has been done, so you may be able to benefit by that. The issuing of comfort and status letters is a tool that different regions use in different ways, but in Region 4, was a very strong tool for us to use to help memorialize what we talk about in the PPI call. Once we finished the PPI call and the developer said they wanted to move forward, or the prospective purchaser said they wanted to move forward, then we would issue them a comfort letter, which would memorialize what we talked about. It's not a, you know, release from liability or anything like that, but it just kind of writes everything down so that, you know, we can all refer back to it. Ready for reuse determinations are great in certain situations. They take longer than a comfort letter, but kind of lay out, you know, kind of, I call them the cliff notes of a Superfund site. You just in a few pages kind of lay out the cleanup and where you're at and where we're going. And then EPA guidance and policies that you could find from the website. I guess a lot of the rest of them are kind of legal tools, and so I'll ask Phil to explain those.
Okay, so very quickly, Common Elements is a guidance document that was an interim document from 2003. It's been revised. It's a very significant document because it talks about the common elements needed for by a purchaser for not only a Superfund site but also a contiguous property owner and innocent landowners. It's a good tool. The Revitalization Handbook identifies all of these tools, and if you go on to the EPA website and type in Revitalization Handbook, it is you will come up with this, and it will list through and give you links to all of these tools. That handbook is being reworked, and it's going to be updated by December, when there's a Brownfields conference, and so that's a significant piece of information that holds a lot of other information. Same with the Superfund Task Force. You can, again, look up the final Superfund Task Force and see what some of these tools were that speed up the cleanup process and the redevelopment process. Two significant things, the BFPP work agreement and the prospective purchaser agreement. These are actual physical documents signed by DOJ, EPA, and the purchaser. It provides liability relief depending on your status as a bona fide prospective purchaser, or if there may be a reason that you don't exactly qualify as a BFPP, we are using the prospective purchaser agreement to, again, provide you with that liability protection that purchasers need when they are redeveloping property. Reuse assessments are, Bill kind of mentioned this earlier, but it's like what can be used here? Can this site be used for planting trees and using the groundwater for that? No, it can't, because the groundwater is contaminated. So those things come into play when we do a reuse assessment. And So the other stuff, again, can be found in the Revitalization Handbook and Superfund Task Force. And there's some coordinators information that I think Frank is going to be talking about now. Hang on, let me get the next. So this is Superfund Task Force. Again, that's the website. It talks about a lot of these tools that have been upgraded and enhanced over the last several years. So I will turn this back over to Frank, and take it away, Frank.
Okay, thanks, Phil. I know we're running short on time, and I think Gene is going to let us go about 5 minutes over, so I'll try and be really quick, move on to the next slide. Here's a list of all of our SRI coordinators. There's at least one coordinator in each region to support reuse at the site-specific level. If you need more information about an existing reuse project or would like to discuss reuse opportunities at a site near you, please feel free to reach out to your regional coordinator. Next slide. Here is my contact information. If you have any general questions or would like more information about SRI, don't hesitate to contact me. And I think we're going to try and get a few questions here. Phil, the first question is to you. Do you find that developers are reluctant to move forward without a comfort letter dealing with the issues of windfall liens?
Again, windfall liens do not come up very often, but comfort letters are easy to draft. They take far less time than agreements. And so any region, any developer approaching a regional office about getting a comfort letter will get one fairly quickly. But again, windfall liens are fairly rare, and we are very willing to work to resolve those lien issues, whether it's through a letter, an agreement, or whatever. But generally, we don't see that much because, again, those sort of liens are pretty rare.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Another question, this probably can be answered by multiple members of the group. Can a site be redeveloped before the cleanup is completed?
So this is Bill. I'll be glad to take that one unless, I'm sorry, Frank, did you assign that to somebody or would you like me to take it?
Oh, no, Kat or Bill is fine.
I'll start and then Kat, you can join in. The answer is yes. In fact, in Janet's case, we're still cleaning up the groundwater on that site. While we address the soil, to the extent we needed to, the groundwater is still being addressed through the remedy. And in most, I would say most redevelopments, the redevelopment occurs before the cleanup is completely done and a site is deleted from the MPL.
And
yeah,
I just want to add
that. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, this is Phil. I just want to add that a lot of times the actual redevelopment of the site can enhance the cleanup, and it was the case in Solitron, but a lot of times, like if there's a cap, people can put a cap or a parking garage over that, and that enhances the site and allows that part of the site to be cleaned up and redeveloped quicker.
This is Kat, and that's absolutely right. I think there is a pretty pervasive misperception out there that the redevelopers have to wait until the site's cleaned up, and that's actually not true. In fact, the sweet spot, the most successful redevelopment is when we can identify the redevelopment as early as possible, and then we can maximize and synergize and get faster cleanup and better redevelopments and cleanups.
Okay. We do have some other questions, but in the interest of time, we'll get back to everyone. We'll follow up via email and hopefully answer everyone's questions. I wanted to close on first thanking all the presenters for some fantastic presentations. It was interesting to hear about Solitron Microwave, and I'd just like to point out that this project was such a success that in December of 2008, this project received what was called the Excellence in Site Reuse Award. It was the first one that was established, and we've given out probably about 30 or 40 awards since then, and it's been the model. So I just wanted to mention that, and I'll turn it back over to Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much. I'll walk through just a few quick final reminders before we close out today's live broadcast. I want to echo the thanks to our organizers from SRI, as well as all the presenters who took time to join us for today's session and share their expertise. I also want to thank the nearly 90 individuals who stuck with us despite the rescheduled date on a Friday afternoon. You all still checked in and engaged in the session, so we hope that you found this a valuable expenditure of your time. If you're interested in finding out about more of these sessions, you had an opportunity to add your name to a distribution list on the previous screen. You can also sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Clue-In Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month, where we list information about cleaning up hazardous waste sites as well as free internet seminars such as today's. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, we have those posted already on the seminar resources page. You'll find it under the middle right under related URLs. It's also in the question window. I shared it with everybody earlier. If you need to go back to your email confirmation message when you signed up, there's a link to the homepage, and you can jump to the resources from there as well. Contact information for our organizers can also be found there, as well as those regional Superfund coordinators, so you can certainly reach out to them directly. And I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. One of the most frequent questions I get as a moderator is if we offer credit hours or CEUs for the sessions. While we don't issue those specific credits, you can get a participation certificate, and if you save that along with the materials and sometimes your registration email, that's usually enough to document your participation for your own accrediting institution. So I will let everybody know if you fill out the online feedback form and when you get to the bottom of it, you check the box to certify you were there for the whole thing. As soon as you submit your feedback in, you'll have access to a certificate of participation with details on the session, including a link to the materials, which you can then save or print out for your own records. If you don't check that box, we will not issue a certificate. And if you happen to join in a group from a conference room, each person in that room can fill out the feedback form on their own and then get their own certificate, even if you didn't register individually. So I would ask those of you who did register in the room to share the link to the feedback form with the colleagues who joined you to view together as a group. And so with that, we did record today's session. I apologize for running just a few moments over.